Tell the Angels, so sings Cindy Morgan. 12.5 minutes after the hour on a mellifluous, that's a mellifluous Monday. This is a winsome Wednesday morning here around the Broken Road. Doug Greenwald joins us now from Columbia, Maryland. Doug is the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times, a wonderful ministry. If you haven't visited their website, you really ought to. One, you'll be impressed with the way it looks, and two, you'll be impressed with the sheer volume of resources on historic and cultural context. Not only the Hebrew context, but in recent months, now also the context of the Roman Empire, the things that Paul was dealing with as he was nurturing his churches across the Roman Empire. Doug, good morning. Happy Wednesday to you. How are things in Columbia? Are you getting rain, snow? What, you're in the middle of that big weather system, aren't you?
Well, yeah, supposedly. Every time I hear a weather forecast, it seems to be less severe as to what's going to happen to us than it was 2 hours before. Mm. Right now it's raining, and maybe that's going to change to 1 to 3 inches of snow, but that's even up for debate. They said in the Shenandoahs and the Alleghenies there's going to be much more snow accumulation. I haven't heard an update on that. But having been up in Minneapolis a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, you were up here, yeah.
Yeah, where it was a high of 23 and a low of 8. This is okay here
you'll settle for that.
We can deal with it.
Okay. Well, I just get a kick out of watching weather forecasts because they dramatize the weather show these days as if we've never seen this kind of thing before, as if we're not equipped to deal with it. I mean, it's nice to know a storm is coming. But on balance, you can open the door, see what's going on for yourself, and then adapt. You know,
well, I think what happened in Buffalo has given the word storm a new dimension.
Well, that was a storm. Yeah.
And now everyone tends to think more severely than more easily when that word is tossed around.
Mm. Other not so nice things happening across the country. Thinking of Ferguson, Missouri, and the demonstrations. It kind of surprised me how broad was the reaction to this. I mean, coast to coast, New York, Los Angeles, Portland, Oregon had demonstrations, Washington, D.C. did, Minneapolis did. I mean, it's kind of the tenor of the times, I suppose, huh? A lot of angry people out there?
I can't tell whether there are a lot of angry people out there, and I noticed I was caught CNN for a moment. I don't know what city they were flying over in a helicopter, Atlanta or something. And there was a group of people down in an intersection. I quickly said, oh, that looks like 100 people. And Anderson Cooper quickly said and estimated it at several hundred people. Mm. And I thought, well, there's a lot of people in Atlanta. 100 out of 8 million or whatever it is. Why are we focusing on such a minority of people? I'm not using minority racially. I'm just using it in terms of numerical count. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of just the bias of the news media. Their paradigm is there ought to be outrage, so let's do whatever we can find to photograph something that qualifies mm-hmm. as outrage. And then create a mosaic as if this is just sweeping the country. And I don't know whether it is or isn't sweeping the country. I do remember, back in Israel, maybe was it a year ago, when the first wave of missiles was coming, rockets was coming out of Gaza. And one of them actually reached the suburbs of Jerusalem. John Delancey actually was telling me this. He was on one of the main streets of Jerusalem, and there were people all sitting in cafes and drinking coffee and just having a normal day in the suburbs of Jerusalem, as always. And then there was a CNN filming crew with Christiane Amanpour with a mic in her hand saying, "This city is on edge. The streets are empty. People are all concerned." And John Delancey's just scratching his head and said, "What she's reporting bears no relationship to what's just unfolding here before my eyes." And so that's always my reaction to news reports. I mean, what am I getting here? What am I getting, a slant? Am I getting a predetermined outcome? in the editing of what they're showing me. It just causes me to wonder.
Well, it's interesting that that's usually the first question David asks when he hears a news story, when we start to ruminate. What's the agenda of the source here, of the provider of the news? What are they really trying to accomplish with this? Not so much the story itself, but all this activity across America is mildly surprising to me, that there is this subset of people, or a set of people, no matter how small, that somehow feels justified in reacting. A lot of them are peaceful, and they intend to be peaceful, but there are people out there that take advantage of the situation and turn it around.
There's a whole chicken and egg thing here, mm-hmm. It seems to me, and the media is front and center. They're sort of the shell of the chicken and the egg, and there's so much talk about, well, when the verdict comes down, there's probably going to be a riot. And how are you going to control the riot? And so if there isn't a riot, it's like we haven't met our expectations that have been created. And so there's really an interesting phenomena here, is to what extent does the media create expectations that then people feel obligated not only to fulfill, but justified in so doing. Mm-hmm. It's a fine line, but...
One of the things I learned long ago, too, and this was in a small town in Kentucky, was how fast word travels, even without the mass media, even without the internet and Facebook and Twitter. And I'm wondering if in either Israel in the first century, or in the Roman Empire during Paul's time there, latter part of the first century, if word didn't travel equally as fast. I mean, word of mouth can be very rapid. It's almost like everybody gets the word at once somehow. I don't know how that mechanism works.
Well, word of mouth in the first century is very local. You know, the vast majority of people who live in a town probably are born and die in that town, and other than going to the temple in Jerusalem for major festivals, probably don't venture more than a mile away from their town in their whole lifetime. Mm-hmm. So in village life, village culture in the first century, I mean, one of the things you need to factor into the stories that Jesus tells in parable form and the encounters of when Jesus enters a village is in a Near Eastern village in the first century, probably even today, there are no secrets. There's no such thing as privacy. I mean, if a family has a problem, the whole village knows it within an hour. And so you kind of have to factor that in to understanding, for example, the prodigal sons in Luke 15.
Now you say plural, prodigal sons.
Well, that's because the elder son is as lost as the younger son. He just never left home. But in terms of being estranged from his father, he's as estranged as the younger son.
And that would be their understanding of that story, wouldn't it, then?
Oh, and very quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, when the younger son, in verse 2, the second verse of Jesus' parable, says, "Father, I want my inheritance and I want it now." Basically, he's slandering his father and saying, "I wish you were dead." It's an incredible insult to the family, and therefore it's an incredible insult to the village. And when in the next sentence, the father distributes his wealth, and the younger son accepts his one-third, and the elder son accepts his two-thirds, Everybody knows that in the village. Everyone is stunned that the elder brother accepted his two-thirds. He should have never done that. Everyone knows the elder brother has the birthright. The person who holds the birthright is mandated to resolve all conflicts between the father and the other siblings in the family. The silence of the elder brother is deafening to Middle Eastern ears. And all of that's taking place in the first two or three sentences. And so, yes, you've got to factor the community, the village, into these stories. And that's why the father is going to kill the fatted calf and have a celebration and invite the village elders to the feast, because not only does his younger son have to be reconciled with his father and that be evidently shown, but he has to be reconciled with the village as well.
So all those hard feelings need to be assuaged then.
Absolutely. And so the village in Jesus' time is often a silent participant in these stories and in these encounters. Now, to what extent people in the next village 3 miles away knew about all this, that's another question. I would think not too much. Mm-hmm. Social media would have kept it very local, not suddenly across the United States like Facebook and Twitter and all these things do today. But getting back to Ferguson for a moment, I think what's really struck me is how whatever perspective you have on the proceedings of Ferguson and the outcome, is everyone is stuck in a paradigm. There's a group of people who from the get-go were convinced that Michael Brown was just slaughtered, basically, by a white police officer. And they have not changed that paradigm from day one. And there's another group of people who said, I'm not so sure, but let's wait for the data. And then finally the data comes out, and at least at my reading and listening to reports, the preponderance of data supports the officer. And there's another group of people said, yeah, we knew that all the time. He was justified within the police protocols of the state of Missouri of doing what he did because Michael Brown actually seems to have functioned as the aggressor. That's their paradigm. And I don't think anybody's changed their paradigm, regardless of what the data says. And the facts come out, and the preponderance of data seems to suggest that Michael Brown was not behaving very well. And yet the other side will say, no, the data is inconclusive. But why is it inconclusive when 80% of the people confirm one story and only 20% suggest another, and a number of those actually admitted that they were lying? Well, it's still inconclusive. It's not clear. And so both sides are stuck in their paradigms, only process the data through their paradigms. And that reminded me of how context is often received and responded to in the Western Evangelical Church. Uh-huh. I've got my paradigm of what these Bible stories say, and I don't want it messed with. And you can do this context stuff all you want and say, here's the original meaning, and I'm not buying it. I'm going to stick with the birth of Jesus with an inn. And, you know, they got there at 10 o'clock at night, and there was a no vacancy sign, and I'm going to have horses and cows in a stable. And that's it. Mm-hmm. I'm not open to anything else.
You know, I'm struck by a comment that David made to me about a year ago, because he had a Bible study at his church, and they were using some of your books, and he was bringing your thoughts on context to them. And I think some of them actually attended your Bible Life seminar here a year ago. And afterwards, David was talking with them, and he noticed they were kind of upset. And they said, you know, what's getting under your skin about all this? They said, well, we just like it the old way. You know, before the light went on, they were more comfortable with things then. They were used to it. It was their everyday understanding of the way God works. And now there's change coming into their view, and they kind of resented it. And I guess I'm not surprised. I'm dismayed.
Well, you know, if you look at the Western Evangelical Church, same phenomena. People are stuck in different paradigms. Mm-hmm. People have different paradigms of what church should be about. They have different paradigms of about the worship experience should be about. They have different paradigms of what adult Christian education should be about. They have different paradigms of what the, quote, familiar, unquote, stories of Scripture are about. And all of us are stuck in our paradigms, or to use an alliteration here, we're all respectively prisoners of our paradigm. And when data comes along and experiences come along that are outside the boundaries of our paradigm, we struggle. Mm-hmm. The technical word for it is called dissonance. All of a sudden, what we've just heard and what we just experienced is contrary to what we thought was true. And it's how we respond to that and how we handle that says a lot about our character, our willingness to be open to other ways of looking at things, our willingness to actually change and modify our philosophies, sometimes our ways of understanding aspects of dogma and theology. And so, you know, the same stuck in my paradigm phenomena mm-hmm. that we see on TV on any subject. I mean, just look at Democrats and Republicans. Talk about two groups of people yeah. stuck in different paradigms.
Just anchored.
We see the same thing in the church, and we shouldn't be surprised. But once again, I see different camps entrenched in their respective paradigms as surrounds the whole Michael Brown Ferguson, Missouri experience. And I've said, yep, I've seen that before when it comes to biblical context. Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a book that's come to my attention over the past 2 weeks since I've talked to you last. And it was a result of a lunch conversation I had with one of the pastors at our church. He said, did you come to the last service? And I said, well, no, I didn't. I woke up that Sunday and I just was lying in bed and I was thinking, I don't want to drive in half an hour in severe weather to sit in a church service where I know at each moment what's going to be said, who's going to say it, and what's going to be happening. And rather, I created for myself in my mind, it was almost a dream vision of my ideal church service.
Mm-hmm.
And I described it to him, the church service, and it was a different physical surroundings and different procedures and just a little different slant on how to worship and how to give praise. And he laughed and he said, you know, here's a book that you would love to read. You would find this worth your while, because he did. And it's called Pagan Christianity. Have you heard of it?
Yes, I have.
Mm-hmm. And it's in essence all about history and context. And its major point is that so many of the traditions and worship practices that we do routinely here, that are part of our every Sunday experience, don't come from the New Testament, but rather come from the Roman Empire and from pagan worship practices. And it's well documented, its history is. I mean, there's footnotes, and you can accept it or not. It's bound to ruffle the feathers of lots of people. But again, it speaks to the point of being mired in a paradigm where this is all ordained by God, that the pulpit should be there and the choir should sing here. And some of those things had nothing at all to do with the first church.
Well, at some future point in time, we'll get into the Pauline experience here, mm-hmm. and we'll talk about the parallelisms between the Holy Roman Empire and the Catholic Church. And it just sort of takes your breath away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the emperor goes away. Well, the pope moves into his place.
Mm-hmm.
The precepts go away, but the cardinals take over. And you go right on down the line.
Mm-hmm.
The household gods go away, but now we have patron saints.
And you mentioned, too, one time already about the basilica. Tell us about that.
Well, the basilica used to be the building where Rome kept the official records of marriages and births, what have you.
It was kind of a city hall.
In fact, in John, when it talks about the royal official in Cana, who goes to seek Jesus out because his son is dying, the word translated royal official is basilicus.
Hmm.
He was in charge of the Roman record keeping, the administrative center in Capernaum. Well, the record-keeping center goes away, and it becomes a church, and we call it a basilica.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so the parallelisms are just amazing between the structures, the strata that the Roman Empire had, the practices that the Roman Empire had, and how the historic Roman church almost picked him up per se and give him a little different twist, a little different meaning.
But now the question here is, this is like two sides of the same coin. Either paganism intruded its way into the church, or the church and its burgeoning hierarchy during that time, I mean, it was mushrooming with, you mentioned cardinals and bishops and a pope, looked at paganism and said, if we do this their way, they will more readily adopt the Christian version of the holiday. I think of Easter, I think of Christmas, and probably others as well. I don't know who initiated that move, or it was simply both at the same time that moved together.
Well, two thoughts. I mean, if you're in the early days of the historic Roman Church, you realize that the Roman Empire has lasted almost 1,000 years. 500 years, it was a republic. In the last 450 years, it was an empire. That's pretty lasting.
Mm-hmm.
And so there must be something good about the structure that Rome put in place to maintain stability and continuity. So I don't fault them for the parallelisms, but there's an interesting phrase. we ran across one day when we were being taught these kinds of insights. The theme for the day was, when Christianity began to overtake Rome, Rome began to overtake Christianity. And that's exactly the thesis that you're talking about.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And another one of the minutiae I learned was that the term Pontifex Maximus, which now refers to the Pope occasionally, they use it that way, originally was the title for the high pagan priest in Roman, and actually was continued by Constantine, and he inherited that title as well, even though we think of him as the first Christian emperor.
Well, in Roman life, every morning, the paterfamilias, the mm-hmm. head of the household in his villa, would go to his tablinum, his office, and would light votive candles and incense as part of his ancestor worship. And he had masks there of his prominent ancestors, and so ancestor worship was a big, big deal. And so votive candles and incense just moved their way into the church, you know, then with the next cycle of how these things come around. So, you know, the parallelisms are all over the place, and it's just sort of fascinating.
It is fascinating, because I personally have always been a fan of history, and learning how we got to be who we are and where we are has been a passion for me all my adult life. And the things you're bringing us in these conversations and in your monthly reflections are just aiding and abetting my passion, and I'm enjoying them immensely, learning a lot. Again, Doug is the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. Would like to recommend that people visit your website, Doug. You can link to it from ours at brokenroadradio.com if you happen to be listening there now. One click will get you there. It's a beautiful website, and there are pictures there of your recent trips through Italy and your Pauline Studies tour, are there not?
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's, in the 10 minutes we have left, let me just do a brief contextual thought here.
Yeah.
The Roman Empire had a lot of admirable qualities about it. And one of them was the preciseness and the thoroughness by which they designed a city. And so I've actually have a book here in my library of how Rome designs a city for 50,000 people. And they lay it out with surveying instruments, and everything is at right angles. And every city that they build, the main north-south street, a highway, actually the Cardo, is named the same in every one of their cities. The main east-west drag is called, has another name, the Decumanus. And all of the blocks are laid out in 80-yard squares. They're called insula. All the heights of the curbs are 18 inches. The width of the roads in the city, the streets in the city can never be more. The buildings can never be more twice as high as the width of the road, so that they always get adequate sunlight into the city. They engineer fabulous aqueduct systems to bring water in from, you know, 13, 15, 20 miles away. They'll actually, in the initial build of the city, they'll put in a sewer system, I know, underground. I mean, they really are thorough. And have designed almost a utopian city from an architectural point of view. Unfortunately, they couldn't control the amount of people that came to the cities and how fast these cities grew. So while a city in its early days may have been designed for 50,000 people, and when it started only 20,000 people lived there, and it quickly grew to 50,000 people as people flocked from the countryside to the cities, the people still kept coming. And all of a sudden, you know, you wake up one morning and a city designed for 50,000 people actually has 150,000 people living in it. And so to deal with that, they began to build what we would call today tenements. And these tenements would be 6, 7, 8 stories tall. And obviously they had no elevators. So, you know, the higher you went up, the lower the rent you paid. And in some of the top floors, there would be one room and 8 people would be living in that one room. They each would have a stall, almost like the lockers, you know, in a high school. And so you get the idea of very crowded. And these tenements were built not in the same rigorous building code manner as the initial city was under Roman specifications, and the upper floors became not always well built and stabilized. And so, you know, maybe once a week, a tenement building of 6 to 8 floors would just collapse and killing dozens, if not hundreds of people.
Now, were these stone buildings? Did they use frame construction? How did they do that?
The first two floors might well have been stone, but after that it was wood. Mm. But here's the point I want to focus on for our final thought here this morning. After the 50,000 people population limit was reached, and it kept growing and growing and growing, the initial sewer system that Rome put in was totally inadequate for the task. I mean, it still would drain from the villas in the major neighborhoods that were part of the initial design, but there were no sewers whatsoever brought to these tenements that just began to spring up all over the place. And so you had your chamber pots, and when your chamber pot was full and you were on the 7th floor, you had to carry that chamber pot down 7 floors, and you would just dump it into the street, sort of where the street and the curb came together, so it would start draining in a certain direction. And sometimes if you were late at night or you were just too lazy, you would just take your chamber pot and you'd just put it out the window and tip it upside down and splatter it all over the sidewalk. And the thing that I want, the point I want to make here is when we walk through the remains of places like Pompeii or Ephesus or Herculaneum, what we don't get a feel for is the stench of the city. It was unbelievable. The smell was everywhere. There is a reason that incense was a big seller in the first, second, and third centuries in the Roman world. And even if you had a fabulous villa, you couldn't keep the smell out. And so with that as a backdrop, let me just read 2 Corinthians 2, 16, 17, and 18, okay? But thanks be to God who always leads us captives in Christ's triumphal procession. That's a whole Roman picture all by itself. And uses us to spread the aroma of the knowledge of him everywhere. For we are to God the pleasing aroma of Christ among those who are being saved and those who are perishing. To the one, we are an aroma that brings death, okay? And to the other, an aroma that brings life. Here's the point I want to make here. The context for the word aroma is not a faint, delicate smell. It has to be a powerful smell to penetrate the stench of sewage in this culture. So with that backdrop, you know, we often use that word aroma of Christ as if we're a faint whiff in the air of the room.
And no, normally pleasant, yeah. Otherwise smell or stench if we're negative, yeah.
The context here is to be very prominent, to be very bold, because it needs to overcome the stench of death and the stench of sewage in this culture.
Excellent example of what context can teach us, why he picked those words in that situation. Yep. Indeed.
Aroma had a very special meaning to people in those centuries.
Well, Doug, thank you for joining us today. Again, I want to recommend that people pay visit to the website, preservingbibletimes.org. Are you going to be with us next week?
I certainly will. Look forward to it.
Yeah, I know we're getting close to the Advent material that you've treated us with in the past. You're looking forward to that. Do have a great Thanksgiving, and say hello to Nancy for us, okay?
And the same for you and yours, and David and Carol as well.
And may you see sunshine by this afternoon.
I can forego the sunshine as long as I don't see white stuff around me.
Doug, we'll catch you next Wednesday. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Jim.